Today's Teisho will be on case 5 in the Pienu, the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 5 is entitled Seppo's A Grain of Rice. Engo's Introduction: To guard and maintain the essential teachings of Buddhism must be the vocation of the noble person. He does not blink when killing a man, and then the man may be instantly enlightened. Hence he observes and acts simultaneously, and holds fast and lets go without restraint. He sees that essence and phenomenon are not two, that experience and reality run parallel. He often rejects the first principle and adopts the second. This is because to cut through the complications too abruptly causes the beginner to lose his footing. A day like yesterday, that could not be avoided. Again, a day like today, his transgressions fill the heavens. If you are clear-sighted, however, you cannot blame him. If otherwise, you put yourself in the tiger's mouth. You will lose your life instantly. Now see the following. Main subject. Seppo addressed the assembly and said, "All the great world, if I pick it up with my fingertips, is found to be like a grain of rice. I throw it in front of your face and you do not see it. Beat the drum, telling the monks to come out to work and search for it." Secho's verse, "The ox head disappearing, the horse head appears. No dust on the mirror of the patriarch Soke. You beat the drum and search for it in vain. For whom do the spring flowers bloom?" Thank you very much for coming to practice Zen today. If you buy a book, an introductory book on Buddhism, like Buddhism for Dummies, there actually is such a book, it will give you basic Buddhist teachings, basic Buddhist principles. So you can read, if you buy the book, one of the first things it begins with is a biography of the Buddha. And then it includes a sort of summary of the Buddha's teachings, starting with the Four Noble Truths. And then it moves from the Four Noble Truths to the Eightfold Path, and so on. And it looks at the different schools of Buddhism, and it lays out their basic beliefs. And it would be very good if you wanted to buy Buddhism for Dummies or some other book, to buy it and read it. You should definitely know about the Four Noble Truths. You should definitely know about the Eightfold Path. You should definitely know about the paramitas, or the paramis, the 10 forms of moral excellence. All of those things are quite important. But, you know, people can get attached to those, even though they're important, and they're very important to know, and valuable to learn, and should never be held in contempt. Nevertheless, knowing them does not necessarily bring you any closer to awakening. So, when Buddhism came to China, it came in over a long period of time, starting around the time, one in the Common Era, the first century of the Common Era, and continuing in sort of like a series of waves from India. And Chinese people took the Dharma very seriously. You know, so you know, when they began to translate Buddhist sutras and other texts into Chinese, they really tried to make sure that the translations were accurate. And various emperors funded research or translation projects with some really very gifted Indian and Chinese translators. And they worked very hard to get the language of the sutras correctly translated into Mandarin. You know, the Chinese took all of this knowledge very seriously, as they should have. And they did an excellent job of making sure that the teachings of the Dharma were translated in ways that were accurate and that people could understand. You know, as a result of these efforts, you know, Buddhism became quite successful in China. In fact, you could really say that China today is the homeland of Buddhism. Since internal conflicts destroyed Buddhism in India, you know, its second home has become its home for more than, really, more than 2,000 years. It's very important to read the sutras. It's very important to understand the basic principles of Buddhism. And I highly recommend reading the Diamond Sutra and the Heart Sutra, of course. And there are some other sutras which are well worth reading, although they're very challenging. Please do study those things. After a few centuries, Chinese people, monks and nuns and masters of different Buddhist traditions in China, realized that there was a danger of people simply learning the ideas and not transforming their real consciousness. It's possible to read the Diamond Sutra and not really undergo any kind of serious change. You know, you have the ideas down, but it doesn't change the way you interact with other people or with the world on a moment-by-moment basis. One way to think about Zen is that the Buddhist teachers in China realized that Buddhism was in danger of becoming a religion, you know, basically. You know, so people could go to the temple and they could light incense, and they could recite sutras, or have monks and nuns recite sutras for them, and then go home. And the monks and nuns would study the sutras, they would light incense, they would do rituals, but that was it. And of course, if that was all there is to Buddhism, it would be not much, right? Not much. The truth of the Dharma, the truth of Buddhism, is really much deeper than that. It's about becoming a Buddha, becoming a Buddha. So even though it seems quite remote as a possibility, you know, all of us are practicing Zen to liberate ourselves from our suffering, from the illusions that cause that suffering. And as we go through this process, we become more aware of the suffering of others. You know, so, usually our suffering is so great initially that we don't really notice the suffering of others. But as we begin to have less suffering ourselves, we begin to notice the suffering of others. And eventually, the desire to transform yourself evolves into a desire to alleviate suffering for all sentient beings. This is the teaching. So there's a lot to Buddhism. You know, it's really not about believing any particular set of... I shouldn't put it that way. There are definitely beliefs that are the foundation of Buddhism. There are definitely beliefs, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Paramitas. These are all very important. These came out of the Buddha's mouth, and we should be aware of them. So knowing those things is important. But just knowing those things doesn't transform us into Buddhas. So the practice of Chan, the practice of Zen, is the heart of Buddhist life. So if people stopped doing Zen and they just studied the sutras, the Buddhism would no longer be alive. It would be an empty shell of its real being, yeah, what it really is. So Chinese masters realized, you know, there is some danger of Buddhism becoming an empty shell where everybody knows these sutras, everybody understands them, but they're not undergoing transformation, So one of the solutions to this problem that great Chinese masters came up with were koans. So today, some of you are here for the first time, this talk is on what's called a koan. Basically, great Chinese Buddhist teachers collected stories that describe moments of when people experience enlightenment or awakening, or moments when great teachers presented a glimpse of enlightened mind to their students. Whether the students understood it or not at the time is another thing. But koans are really stories about enlightenment. And they're difficult to understand because they call into question the way we ordinarily experience the world. So these stories are designed to shift our mental processing, to change the way we are experiencing the moment and bring us closer to enlightenment. Because we are not enlightened, when we hear the koan, it often seems completely incomprehensible. You know, so you'll hear this story and you'll think, "What is? I didn't understand one word of that." Right? So for example, you know, Engo says to guard and maintain the essential teachings of Buddhism must be the vocation of the noble person. Okay, got it. He does not blink when killing a man. You think, killing? But that's, you're not allowed to, you know, take the precepts, you know, we vow not to kill. How can you kill? So instantly, it makes no sense. He does not blink when killing a man, and then the man may be instantly enlightened. So you think, well, how can he be enlightened if he's dead? See? Hence, he observes and acts simultaneously. How could he observes, he looks, he sees, and he acts at the same time. How is that possible? Normally, we contemplate or we act, but we don't contemplate and act at the same time. Holds fast and lets go without restraint. What is this about? See, none of this makes much sense when you hear it. Because it's presenting the view of a person who is deeply awake. And because we aren't deeply awake, when we hear this, it's very confusing. So the function of the koan is to change the way we experience the moment by, you could say, forcing us to go through a little bit of a crisis. You know, every once in a while in life, just ordinarily, people go through a kind of crisis. You know, so I have a friend of mine whose father was a very strict disciplinarian, very strict. And he raised his children in a very strict way. And then, he was dealing with his grandchild. And he realized that the way he had raised his children was completely wrong. It was like a big mistake. You know, he had thought that if you use discipline, your children will grow up to be disciplined. But his grandchild, you know, was like out of control. And the more he tried to discipline the child, the worse things became. So, you know, he had these beliefs about the world, and the world didn't accept his beliefs, basically. And now he's in a great uncertainty about what to do. You know, how do I solve this problem? Everything I have done to help my grandchild is screwing things up even worse. And I see that in many ways, the things I have done have created the problem or made the problem worse. So this is like a real life crisis. A real life crisis. You know, people go through these crises all the time. So another example, you know, a friend of mine, a woman I know, has just gone through a divorce, a very painful experience of divorce. You know, she got married fairly young and thought their relationship was just wonderful. And then one day her husband said, actually came home and said, I'm going to Seattle, goodbye. And he had met a person at a conference in Seattle and was leaving her. And it's as though her entire world fell apart, you know. And now she's asking herself, you know, why didn't I see the signs of his unhappiness? And he betrayed her. She didn't betray him. Why didn't she notice that he was not a trustworthy person, really, you know? How could she have missed that, you know? So there are many dimensions to this problem, and she finds herself going over and over the past, trying to understand where she went wrong. Well, in each of these cases, the people can't solve the problem until they see life in a different way. They have to go through a kind of like a revolution inside themselves. And they have to see life in a totally different way. The old way of seeing isn't any good. And this is, in a way, how koans work. You know, they create a kind of crisis where you realize my old way of seeing isn't working. I have to see things in a new way. So this is actually a brilliant way to teach Buddhism. Instead of just telling people, here's how you should behave, these koans are designed to teach people how to see like a Buddha sees, how to hear as a Buddha hears, how to feel as a Buddha feels. See, so it's really a brilliant technique. In order to answer your koan, you have to go through a revolution. See, and the way we go through that revolution is through Zazen, Dzogchen, Dzogchen, Zazen, Zazen. I'm mispronouncing that, but Japanese people say Zazen. Easier for English speakers to pronounce. Dzogchen, Dzogchen. Seated meditation. We sit down on the cushion. We watch the breath until we enter samadhi. Samadhi. That's when the mind is calm and stabilized and present in the moment, without grasping for anything beyond the moment. this takes a lot of practice to get to this state. Then we have to go deeper into the mind. So when we go deeper into the mind, we watch the breath until we enter samadhi, and then we begin to practice wuxin, wuxin, muxin. We confront mu, blank mind, muxin, wuxin. When we enter wuxin, or as we try to enter wuxin, we're going down through all the layers of the mind. So sometimes when you come in to sit, you know, you're expecting to have a calm mind, but all this stuff comes bubbling up, seems to come bubbling up. You're watching the breath, you're trying to get into samadhi, you're focusing on the blank mind, and then all this stuff comes up. You know, memories of childhood, things you heard as a little child, on TV, TV shows replay in your head, movies, right? Commercials, right? You'll remember a commercial you saw when you were 10 years old, things like that. Sometimes disturbing things come up. Sometimes even like abstract forms, just like images, the abstract images can come up. Excuse me. If you think about the mind, you could imagine your mind as having a series of layers. So the top layer of the mind is what we call the discriminating mind. It's the mind that verbalizes and thinks in ideas and sentences. So during the sitting period today, some of you might have had thoughts like this. After I leave here, I have to get some dog food. See, the dog is out of dog food. I have to get some dog food. ShopRite is on the way home. This is the topmost layer of your mind. See, under that layer, there's like this river of thought fragments. They're like pieces of thoughts under that layer. And, you know, you sit there and it's just like little pieces, snippets of sentences, pieces of memory, little bits of memory that happened yesterday or today. So that's like this stream of consciousness. And as you're meditating, often people enter this state where it's just stuff flowing by. As you keep watching the breath, it takes you deeper, deeper into the mind, and eventually you begin to get to a place where you have images. Not everybody has this, but sometimes people, when they meditate, they see. You know, beautiful pictures, or they have these images in their mind. Some people don't have that faculty, but in some people, that visualizing mind is very well developed. You know, then you get into like your deep memory, you know, things you've forgotten for 20 years. And finally, you get down, if you keep sitting, you'll get to a place where it's blank and still. This is where we have to go to change the way we see the world. See, great Indian Buddhist thinker whose name was Vasubandhu, said, this is how we liberate ourselves from karma. He called it revolution at the base. He said there's no sense trying to change the way your mind works by messing around with ideas. There's no sense messing around with your memories. It doesn't work. He said you've got to go all the way down to the bottom of the mind and enter that empty place. And that's where you can begin to transform your consciousness. This is called revolution at the base of the mind. And this is a key teaching of Zen. If you ever look at a lineage of all the, you know, a Zen lineage goes all the way back to Buddha, one person after another. So, you know, if you look at my teacher was Webb Roshi, and his teacher was Kanko Roshi, and his teacher was somebody and somebody, back to Han Shanse in Suzhou, and then back all the way to the Buddha. And some lineages actually recite once a year all the people in the lineage. We don't do this, but we could. And one of the people in our lineage would be Vasubandhu. Vasubandhu. In Seattle, we used to recite our lineage all the way back to the Buddha. And we used to recite a person, before I understood any of this, there was a name in the list. We recited the Japanese versions of these names. So we would recite the name of somebody named Vasubandhu. I thought, who is Vasubandhu? Later I realized, Vasubandhu, the great Buddhist practitioner, philosopher, meditator, philosopher. So Vasubandhu is so important to our tradition. He said, in order to liberate yourself from karma and transform the way you see the world, you have to have a revolution at the base. Go to blank mind. And so koan training requires you to perform a revolution at the base. See? And little by little, as we go through these little revolutions in the way we experience reality, we gradually change our consciousness. So at first, the mind, our ordinary minds are quite different from the minds of an enlightened person. But step by step, koan by koan, revolution by revolution, we're changing the way we experience the world. And eventually, people have what's called in Japanese, daikensho, great awakening experience. This is like seeing the source face to face. This is like confronting or discovering in your own mind enlightened consciousness, which is really there. It's really there right now, even as I speak. It's just we get confused and we don't notice it or can't get back to it. But we go through this process of revolution at the base over and over again, and eventually our mind becomes a Buddha mind. So that's the way koans work. This koan is entitled Seppo's A Grain of Rice. Let me return to the koan now. Seppo addressed the assembly and said, "All the great world, if I pick it up with my fingertips, is found to be like a grain of rice. I throw it in front of your face, but you don't see it. Beat the drum, telling the monks to come out to work and search for it." So basically, the koan is grain of rice, grain of rice. Let me just move in a little different direction. It's going to be a bit of a jolt. I hope you didn't watch the Republican National Convention. I really hope you didn't. But you might have. Or you probably watched as much as you could possibly stand, which might not have been very much. I myself did not watch it, but I did read about it in the papers. And I read the speech of Donald Trump's daughter, one of his daughters. And she said, "My father told me, if you have to think, think big. Think big." She said, "My father thinks big. He never thinks any other way than big." after that, I went on to some other story. I couldn't stand it anymore. You know, we all think, even if you're not a Trump fan, you know, we believe very much in thinking big. Big. If you can't have to think big. Big, big. You know. I have a friend of mine. She's a member of our group. Her name is Kriti. She is an environmental scientist. She and her husband are environmental scientists. And they are dealing with, among other things, global warming problems. And I don't, you know, you might have heard, you know, that in China right now, very, very hot, right? Like very, very hot. And flooding, serious in South China, like major, major flooding problems. India, record high temperatures. In the Middle East, record. Baghdad had a temperature of 51 degrees centigrade yesterday. That is 129 degrees. Can you imagine? You know. And in this American Southwest also, you know, like California, part of California had 122 degrees. So, you know, definitely we have a problem. Right, and the scope of the problem is so huge that, you know, environmental scientists keep gathering all these data, and they just keep collecting it, and they keep trying to get it into the newspapers, and it gets into the newspapers, but nothing happens. And you know, actually, I have actually read articles about how environmental scientists get together, and they all have like little groups because they all are in danger of getting depressed. Seriously. You know, their job is to study this problem so that we can solve the problem, but the problem isn't getting solved. So they just keep warning everybody and getting ignored, and they actually suffer from depression. Because they're people of good, of noble intentions, who are trying to help, and it doesn't seem to work. And my friend Kriti, was saying that, you know, she was at a conference of environmental scientists, and you know, they were really experiencing a lot of emotional distress about all of this. The problem is so vast, right? So vast. There's so many dimensions to it, and it seems like, how can we ever solve this problem? And she said, one of the people in her group said, you know, we can cut down on, we can improve mileage on cars. People can buy hybrids. You know, you can plant trees. But he said, it's all just moving the deck chairs on the Titanic, see. So, you know, if you don't know the story, you probably do, but there was a very famous leisure ship where people would vacation at sea called the Titanic. It was supposed to be unsinkable. And it hit an iceberg and sank, which people thought was impossible. And many, many people died. So the Titanic is a symbol of a group of people or a culture or society that doesn't pay attention to its approaching doom. And so instead of slowing down to avoid the icebergs, people are just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. That's the metaphor. So this person said, you know, we can buy a hybrid car, we can plant trees, blah, 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 but it's all just arranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. You know, and basically what he was saying is, we need to think big, big. You know, it's possible in our world to feel that what we do is extremely inconsequential. Extremely inconsequential. You know, because when we look at the world, its problems are so complicated and so vast that it seems that what we're doing, what we can do in our life, doesn't make any difference. Doesn't make any difference at all. It can be very demoralizing to think that way. Even paralyzing. It also isn't really, I don't think it's really true. It's really not true. You know, there's nobody on the planet, not even Donald Trump, who could clap his hands and make everything change. That's not how change happens. You know, in my opinion, and I think this would be the Zen view, you know, that's a fantasy. You know, everything happens one moment at a time, one event at a time. You know, so all change is like, you could say, granular. Change in us, change in the world. There isn't any way to clap your hands and make everything change. The world is made up of little moments, of little grains of time. And everything is a product of what Buddhism calls cooperating causes. So in order for anything to happen, many different things have to happen at the same time. This idea of cooperating causes is very important. It's the essence of Buddhism. You know, nothing happens just in itself. We are all interwoven. Everything happens together with everything else. This is called dependent origination. Dependent origination. Very important Buddhist teaching. This happens because that happens. See, that's so, nothing happens by itself. You can't have a dinner without the farmer. You can't have a farmer without, you know, the wheat. You can't have the wheat without the rain. You can't have the rain without, you know, the right climate, you know, on and on. Everything is interwoven. Everything is interwoven. This is also true for changing ourselves. You know, when people think about enlightenment, they think, I'll go to one sesshin and something will happen and I'll be enlightened. But actually, transforming ourselves is also granular. It's one moment at a time, one breath at a time, one koan at a time. In order to change all the cooperating causes, everything has to happen together with everything else. You know, so it's a fantasy to imagine, you know, that one sesshin, you will go to one sesshin and it's like hitting the jackpot, right? You know, it's like winning the lottery. You know, I went to the sesshin and I did it. It was like my number came up. That's not how it works. It's granular. It's one moment. If you take care of this moment, you're taking care of the world. If you take care of this moment, you're taking care of the whole world at this moment. Because the world is made up of little moments. See, little moments. So it's just not true that you can clap your hands and wake up. You have to take care of this breath, and this breath, and this breath. You know, how you eat your breakfast matters, mindlessly or mindfully. You know, everything you do is contributing, changing the cooperating causes that affect your consciousness. We understand that if you were an impatient person and you were rude to others, it would be quite unusual if you could go to sesshin and have enlightenment. That wouldn't make sense. We can't imagine really that the Buddha was cruel to other people and yet had an enlightenment experience. You know, the teaching is that the Buddha had lived many prior lifetimes. And did you know that the Buddha, in one of his prior lifetimes, is even supposed to have been in hell? Isn't that interesting? So even the Buddha, at one many, many, many lifetimes ago, in Buddhist, you could say mythology, if you want, was in hell, was a person in hell. And according to Buddhist mythology, if you want to put it that way, he was in hell. He must have done something terrible. He must have killed somebody or something. And he and this other person in hell had to push this big cart. It was so heavy they couldn't push it. And every time they failed to push it, this like a demon type being would whip them. And the Buddha suddenly realized that this poor guy next to him was absolutely exhausted and couldn't go on. And the Buddha turned to the demon and said, "Look, you know, I'll push the cart myself. Why don't you give him a breather?" And anyway, according to the mythology, the demon killed him for saying that. But the point is, he noticed the suffering of others for the first time and was reborn in a better form, you know. If you ever read the Jataka tales, the tales of the Buddha's reincarnations, you know, they're filled with stories like in one of his prior lives, the Buddha was a fish. And he was a pond fish. And a drought came, and all the other fish were dying. This is mythology, but you know, the fish, he was like a very good fish. You know, he never ate even a mosquito. He only ate algae and things like that. And the god of rain noticed him. He said, "Oh," he looked down in the pond and he said, "That's a really interesting fish. You know, he actually has never done harm to any living being." And so he asked the fish, "What would you like?" And the fish said, "Please make it rain to help my friends." So the god of rain made it rain. In another Jataka tale, the Buddha was a rabbit. This is a myth, right? The Buddha was a rabbit who everybody admired. All the creatures in the forest thought he was so wise and kind that he was like the king of the forest. So one day this holy man was coming through the forest and all the animals offered him, had to give him good food, you know. So the bees brought him some honey, you know, ants brought him something, sweet fruit or something. And the rabbit didn't, because the rabbit was taking care of all the other animals, he didn't have anything in his rabbit hole except some old dry pieces of grass. So he couldn't offer his dried up pieces of grass. He jumped into a pot and offered himself up as the meal. So these are just stories, but what they're trying to say is that little actions that cultivate goodness and compassion gradually transform us from selfish beings into Buddhas. So you know, the Jataka tales are mythology, but they're stories about basically the Buddha making little gestures to help others, gradually changing himself into this being who is entirely compassionate. See, so it's granular. Moment by moment, you become a Buddha through the choices you make. We all make mistakes, but we learn, you know, little by little, little by little. So I think, you know, we underestimate the value of this moment. You know, you might be, I'm a writing teacher. You know, I correct students' grammar. I improve their writing. You know, it's possible to look at global warming and say, "Huh, who cares about their writing? You know, that's just deck chairs on the Titanic." But, you know, actually, if people can't communicate well, if they can't read and understand things, they might not even understand what's happening. You know, so it's important. I'm here. My job is to correct this paper. I should do it 100%. Do my best job. I'm helping to make the world a different place. It's just a paper, that's true, but the world is made up of little gestures just like that. You know, just like that. The world isn't going to be a better place if some all-powerful person claps his hands. You know, if you had the most virtuous person in the world in the White House and everybody else was corrupt and selfish, nothing good could happen. We all have to make ourselves better people, starting with this moment, if the world is going to be a better place. So you can't jump to the end. You can't go to Sesshin and have an enlightenment experience unless you practice every day or often. And you sit on the cushion and you focus on the breath. You know, take care of this moment. Take care of this moment, this moment, this moment. And if you take care of the moments, you know, the big picture actually works out quite well. If you don't take care of the moments, nothing good can happen. You know, there is, I was reading something about in a magazine about what economists call the multiplier effect. So let's say you hire somebody to fix the porch of your house and you pay him $500, right? Well, you give that person $500, but then, you know, he takes that $500 and he buys an airline ticket for his daughter so she can go to college. See, so you're paying the, you know, basically, then, you know, the people who are paid by the, that $500 gets used for, some of it gets used to pay the pilot who pilots the plane, let's say, and the stewards who work in the plane. And so they take that money and they give it to somebody else. The point is that, you know, if I give you if you give somebody $500, that $500 goes to other people, and then it travels to other people and other people. So over time, $500 becomes like $50,000 in terms of the how many people it changes, in terms of how it moves forward into other people's lives. So I give you $5. You use it to buy a meal. The waitress uses it to pay for diapers for her baby. You know, the person who sold the diapers uses it for something else. So it's five times five times. It's called multiplier effect. So $5 has much more than $5 worth of impact on the society. It radiates out and affects all these different lives and makes it possible for those lives to change. So, you know, actually, if we take care of the moment, you know, there are multiplier effects in everything we do. You know, if you are a writing teacher, you know, sometimes you think, sometimes you think, does this make a difference? You know, the other day I got an email from a student who was my student like 7 years ago. I have to confess I had forgotten all about her. But she said, you know, I still remember your class. I'm writing a report for my job. I wonder if you'd take a look at it. It's like, wow, of course. Absolutely. So you don't know what kind of impact you have. But everything we do, I mean, the lesson of the Jataka tales, these stories of the Buddha's lives, is that there are multiplier effects in everything we do. You know, by the way, just I'll wrap it up. But you know, I do even, I know it sounds crazy in a way, you know, but, you know, you do meet animals sometimes who are really exceptional animals. For many years, my wife had a cat whose name was Max. And Max wouldn't hurt a fly. You know, he was such a sweet animal. It was just amazing. And I have a feeling, you know, Max's consciousness was really unusual. I mean, I have a cat who will kill anything that moves, right? But Max wouldn't, you know? A mouse could climb into his mouth and I don't think he'd hurt it. You know, there are qualitative differences among cats. So who knows? But there are definitely differences. Every moment this universe is a grain of rice. This universe is made up of little grains of rice. And if we take care of this grain of rice, you know, the universe is going to take care of itself.